Hello and welcome back to 24 Hours Don't Make an Ideology, a podcast about the 69th best show of the 21st century. I'm one of your hosts, as always, Ryan Swen, along with
Ian.
And welcome to the second season premiere at long last of 24, covering day two, the hours from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. I realized, actually, as I was looking back at just my old viewing logs, that this was the first set of hours that we covered last year in 2022.
Oh, nice.
which was a sort of funny coincidence.
Yeah, our podcast records on the schedule of a prestige television show, which is that we don't make that many episodes, and for some baffling reason, it takes us like 2 years to make even that paltry amount.
Yeah, I was actually that sort of point about prestige TV, was something I was thinking about sort of in an oblique way, where in diving back into 24, because as you, the listener, know, we definitely have a very strong anti-TV stance on this podcast. And what I realized was that sort of in watching, like, it was definitely for both better and worse, it was like sinking back into a bath watching these episodes. Watching this season premiere. And like, I realized that it's the sort of thing where I think that what I like so much about 24, like in many different, like in many senses of the word, is that it's both prestige TV and trash TV to a certain degree. I feel like it's sort of like it straddles that sort of line where it's a sort of like it is trashy, but also because it's acclaimed and, you know, so consequential in a sort of social political way, I feel like that's what compels me about it and what sort of keeps me coming back to it.
Yeah, well, especially these early seasons, you know, like those battle lines just hadn't been drawn yet.
That's true. Yeah.
You know, you had things like Sex and the City and The Sopranos that were doing something markedly different, but network TV was still a place where you could do like seemingly serious kind of work. Mm-hmm. And I think 24 is like pretty instrumental in how TV gets reconceptualized because of how crazy the serialization is, you know, like taking it to this wild degree of, yeah, you know, it happens in real time, right? And it also shows off the weaknesses of that heavy serialization, which is that some episodes don't feel like anything happened, you know. It often comes up, you know, on Carl's Star Trek threads, you know, this move toward serialization, it becomes a way where you only really have to write one episode, but you have to make it 10 hours long, you know?
Right.
but then it feels like it almost feels like magic then when you watch something that's just like content to do an episode, you know? And 24, I think, vacillates between those two extremes pretty frequently. Like there are times where it feels really constrained. And then there are times where you're like, I know I've watched like 5 hours of this, but I really don't know like what's happened.
right. Yeah. Like the thing I had sort of forgotten about, the experience of watching 24 is that sometimes there are these within an episode, there's just like this really, I wouldn't say elegantly, like, but this very, very sort of clear arc that's set up, like with a character, like with this sort of jerk hacker guy in the second episode. Which is an incredibly sort of satisfying arc.
Yeah. Like it's so good.
So you have like all the action that takes place right within that episode as you need. But then there's also so much else that's just dragging on and on, or sort of like put into, like sort of dropped and left, and then brought up back again when needed. So 24 definitely vacillates between those two tendencies a lot. It has been also very nice just to see that that Carl's finally reached this sort of relative promised land of Strange New Worlds.
Yeah, I mean, it really does. I you know, as a fellow head, it really did just feel like an oasis. But also, like, kind of, it almost makes you mad because you're like, oh, they could have been doing this all along, you know?
Right.
It's like, oh no, we didn't act. It's not, you know, it's not actually that people don't know how to write an episode of television. It's that they weren't doing that for some reason. You know, right. I mean, I'm sure I could get. It's more complex than that, but it just feels like the first couple episodes of Strange New Worlds. Mm-hmm. I remember watching them and just being like, oh. What happened? Why are we only doing this now? And I think even I forget who the showrunner is. I mean, I know Kurtzman is kind of over the whole empire, but you know, I forget who the specific mm-hmm. showrunner of Strange New Worlds is. But essentially, their pitch came down to, "Hey, what if we just made Star Trek?" which is so funny to me. But yeah, I do think, you know, 24, like getting back into a new season. Mm-hmm. There's always a lot of table setting, mm-hmm. But I do think in some ways 24 is interesting in that, you know, it's always ready to yank the tablecloth out from under.
Right.
So I think there is even like in its best moments, attention even to that, mm-hmm. like, you know, this wedding subplot thing is like pretty boring right now. And like, none of these people are interesting, but like, you know, that at some moment, like these things are going to come together and like the other shoe is going to drop. So it keeps you hanging on even when you're like, dear God, Kim, do not go down another alley. I've been through this before.
The you know who else is a Trekkie?
Who?
Dennis Haysbert.
Oh, no way.
Apparently, according to Wiki 24, because his scene partner in a huge chunk of his scenes this season is Michelle Forbes.
Yes.
And Haysbert apparently was thrilled and awestruck to be working alongside her.
That's so sick. He's so cool. Yeah. I think that like you made the prescient observation of the relation between Palmer and Sisko. And now I feel like that's not even like an inference. Like that's on purpose.
It makes me wonder like if we can get and of course because there will also be other Star Trek actors appearing in significant roles throughout the run of 24. Like it makes me wonder if we can get like a sort of reverse pollination thing like what they did with James Callis in Picard.
Yes, yeah.
if we can get Dennis Haysbert in like a good meaty role in I don't know, Strange New Worlds or something like that.
Oh yeah. He would be fantastic. You know, I think that I think maybe we've talked about this on the show before. We certainly talked about it with Carl on Twitter that you know, Star Trek Enterprise is probably going to be a key text in the 24 universe, you know. But yeah, I mean, it is like, okay, another thing that's fun about TV, and like, mm-hmm. yeah, this happens in movies too, but I think TV is different because up until, you know, relatively recently, like, mm-hmm. if you're a TV actor, that's what you did. Like, that was your job. And not that they didn't do other things, but, you know, that's how you made your living. Mm-hmm. And so it's always fun to see people show up in all these different, like once you've watched like enough TV, like it's like a fun game, you know, mm-hmm. especially something like Star Trek that, you know, had so many different people doing bit parts or recurring roles over the years, mm-hmm. To just see them pop up in different things. it's sort of a dumb thing that I feel like it's a pleasure we all sort of experience, that pleasure of recognition. But But I think that's something that's a little bit lost in like the era where, you know, movie stars are having to be in, you know, webisodes. It's just not as fun, you know?
Yeah, I definitely agree. Speaking of the sort of recognition, I think that's something that we both do and don't get in the first scene of this season.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yeah, so, okay, so how did you... I did not remember this at all.
No, I didn't remember this at all either.
So,
Yeah. Well, first off, I love that most, like, 98% of the justification for the first scene taking place in Seoul is so that they could start at midnight again for literally just one scene and, yes, and then and yeah. then bring it back.
Yeah,
I did really like that.
Yeah, that was a nice that was a nice touch for sure.
Yeah. And refresh my memory. Did we have any like any genuine torture scenes in day one at all? Like thinking back on it, I honestly like I can't really remember anything that like was explicitly like that sort of physical torture in that way.
You know, I'm going to look at my notes real quick because I do seem to recall one moment where can I search within. Oh, that seems like a. Oh, there we go. Find in note. Okay.
Because like the closest thing I can really think of is that scene where Jack threatens to torture the guy by shoving a towel down his throat. But beyond that, I can't really.
Yeah,
recall anything else.
That is the only time I have that note. Is in that episode. Yeah, I think that okay. This is firmly a post 9/11 show in season two. You know.
Like it's sort of almost shocking how forthright it is in being a post 9/11 show. Like I think it was as we discussed there were maybe like slight overtures into it stepping into that territory during the latter half of season one, but then season two immediately begins with this guy strapped like to a metal table, his being electrocuted and like having like needles shoved inside of him, and And like this, one thing that like really stuck with me about this scene was A, like how like wide everyone's eyes are bulging.
Yeah.
And, like, especially the people who aren't getting tortured. Like.
Yeah.
And then like how sweaty everyone is. Like when the one of the interrogators goes into an adjoining room, and then there's like all these American generals sitting around a table, everyone's just caked in sweat.
Oh, they're just drenched. Yeah.
And
everything's kind of this sickly green color.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. It's like a green blue sort of thing.
Yeah,
like it wouldn't look out of place in like Traffic, I guess.
Yeah,
sort of film.
Yeah.
And also like most of the screen in during the interrogation is like. I compared it to like a sort of a Wellspring DVD of like a Korean New Wave film where like it's sort of most of the frame is blocked off. So like it's sort of like letterboxed like within a 4x3 screen sort of. And like the subtitles are just on the bottom, like in the sort of dark space.
Yeah, I felt like Quentin Tarantino should have introduced it.
Tarantino has to have talked about 24 at some point, right?
Yeah. Well, I gotta make a note of that to look
yeah.
it up. Yeah. The way they use the sort of like, you know, the Hopkins frame in this mm-hmm. opening scene is really interesting. And also mm-hmm. it's another, you know, I think we talked about it last season, which is that, you know, there's kind of a symptomatic way in which the show prefigures a lot of the anxieties and neuroses of the war on terror even before it happens. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then like here we get, you know, I think Seymour Hirsch's like Abu Ghraib piece is mm-hmm. like in 2004. So this is a couple years before, like, I think that your average person would think specifically of torture as this key to, you know, the war on terror, right? As mm-hmm. this and as this like contentious thing. I think it's certainly not until several years later that, you know, a certain Supreme Court justice cites 24 as justification. But then at the same time, you also have this cultural thing, like immediately watching this scene, I thought of Saw. Right. And then I texted you and you were like, that Saw doesn't come out until after this. And I was like, what?
Yeah.
They're doing and like, it again.
And even though I haven't seen Saw, like it from what I've, the impression I get is that it's much less graphic than this scene.
Yeah, this felt almost.
It felt like elaborate torture traps I've seen glimpses of from like later Saw films. Really.
Yeah, it seemed very much pushing the envelope for television.
Mm-hmm.
It's like pretty visceral, and it's the first scene. Like, imagine, okay? I almost kind of it's perversely respected, which is like, imagine, you know, season one is kind of this cult is maybe not the right word, but a kind of unexpected hit.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, in the
disposable.
Yeah.
Meant to be disposable. Acts like through some sort of alchemy of good timing and a couple of great performances like transcends that.
Yeah, well, you know,
to whatever like, degree can. Of
when
course.
9/11 happens in the middle of your first season of a show about terrorism, like that's just a kind of cosmic sort of fortune that you can't. It's the intangibles, really.
Well, like it's really like if your opening episode ends with a plane being blown up.
Yeah,
like that's really what. Yeah. Kicks into high gear.
Exactly. And so now you've got all these people that are going to be tuning in for season two because they've heard good things. I don't know. Were they doing, did they do like reruns of it in the summer? I don't really remember how it used to work, if I'm being honest.
Sure.
But you know, you certainly weren't queuing it up on Netflix or anything and catching up. So this is like a lot of people's very first taste of this show.
You know?
I mean, the audience is going to expand. And it's like we're tuning in, and then it is just this grotesque, horrifying scene with no characters that we know.
No characters who reappear.
Yeah, primarily in a foreign language.
Yeah.
A bold choice, frankly.
It is.
To just be like, this is the kind of... And it feels like kind of putting a stake down for the kind of show that it will become. Like,
yeah.
Okay, we're not going to have anybody you like doing this yet, but just hang on a minute.
There's a lot of choices, I think, that in these next two episodes, certainly, and I can foresee this being a pattern like that grows increasingly as the show goes along.
Yeah.
In that, like, the sort of thing where there's a lot of choices that I find perverse. Some of those are for like very good and fun reasons, and some of those are absolutely not.
Yeah.
For example, I think there are a lot of very fun cuts between storylines, especially in this first episode.
Yeah.
Like when it cuts from this immediately to just David Palmer fishing.
That's such a good bit. That's so good. And like, okay. And again, almost like I'm giving the show way too much credit here.
Oh, sure.
But there is, I think, you can't fight montage. And there is a reading of that cut that is like, this is actually what it means to be the person who okays this stuff. Like, the dirty work is being done somewhere else. You're on your fishing boat in Oregon, on the lake, having a nice time. And someone somewhere else is, you know, going through the absolute worst, unimaginable amount of pain at your command. You know, you're like this distanced from it. It's also just really funny. But and this episode aired without commercial interruption originally, so
right, yeah,
so this would have been like this is like a straight up, you know, cut. Yeah, it is very jarring and sort of funny, but also like maybe a kind of implicit critique at least of like what kinds of stories we're following and the kinds of people that are involved.
Right. Yeah, it was like I watched for the first time on Hulu instead of other sources, so like unfortunately I didn't get that desired commercial free because like there's a certain elegance I think that it goes to in juggling the storylines. I think it's much more the problem with the actual storylines than with how they're cut together.
Absolutely.
I especially like how it has those sort of those breaks or like the moments when you see the clock when it sort of goes into when it's drawn into like a split screen basically, and then like it brings it up another one and then it cuts to one of the other ones that's on the screen.
Yeah.
I like how it preserves that sort of that sort of pace setting while also not having commercials. Unfortunately, I didn't get that, but like didn't get that actual experience. But I do think that it's for a premiere, I think it's actually a pretty solid premiere in terms of the structure. When you get into the actually actually what's happening, then it becomes a lot more dicey.
Yeah. Well, and I also, like, as part of that structure, it, you know, Jack is almost treated like, you know, Godzilla, right? Like, they withhold him for, it seems like, so long in the episode.
I mean, the first shot of him in, like, it's sort of like a following shot, like, it pans down to his shoes at some points.
Yeah, he's, like, dressed kind of like, you know, kind of schlubby.
Yeah, it's almost like a Darden film at the beginning. Like, where, like, he's seen in behind before he finally turns around, and then he has this, like, this wonderfully disheveled beard.
Yeah, just, like, I love that this is their idea of a guy who has really let himself go after having, you know, an insanely traumatic experience. What is it, 18 months afterwards?
Something, it's a year, like, they say a year. And apparently, like, the Wiki 24 is very clear to specify that the time for difference between Seoul and the West Coast indicates that it's that we're currently in daylight savings time.
So. Yeah.
So, like, maybe like 14 months, something like that.
Yeah. Okay.
Would be my guess.
So somewhere between a year and a year and a half. Yeah.
I think, like, this, especially the best detail about sort of gone to see Jack, is that he's wearing just this enormous coat in the sun.
It's like it's like a flannel coat, but one that's like has a liner in it, so it's
exactly.
Yeah.
And apparently that he keeps his sleeves rolled up under it.
Yeah. Look, I'm not gonna lie, Jack is pretty much wearing what I wear, like, all the time. He's looking pretty much how I would look if I lived in LA.
Well, yeah, and I love especially how, like, when he walks into CTU for the first time, and probably since he was last debriefed, he basically looks like a kid coming back from summer break. Where even though, like, everyone turns around and stares at him, he just, like, looks sort of lost. Like, it's a great sort of feeling.
Yeah, Kiefer takes this kind of, like, it's kind of an interesting read. Because, you know, Jack Bauer is such a kind of intense character.
Yeah.
So Kiefer, in, like, the very earliest bits here, makes him not just kind of vacant and, like, obviously resentful, but, like, sort of bumbling and absent-minded a little bit. Uh-huh. Like, when he goes for the phone when the president's on the line, and he sort of, like, trips over things. And, like, really a guy who just, like, he's kind of fallen apart, but he doesn't know how to fall apart like a normal person, because he's his brain was already broken in a certain way.
Right. Yeah. Like, I love how he still answers his phones the exact same way.
Yeah.
He just looks, says, yeah. Like, he doesn't say his name or anything.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like, it's sort of you like, it's very clearly the same guy. It's not even necessarily that he's like, It's just him expressing himself in a different way. It's not even that he necessarily feels, like, buried under, or that he feels unrecognizable. Like, it's still very much Jack, but, like, it's just, like, just sort of like him in a different frame of mind rather than, like, being radically altered, which I think, like, does feel right for the kind of person that Jack is.
I think the show makes a really kind of, like, bold choice in doing that, because it feels like the kind of gambit, I mean, that they, A, will reproduce later to lesser effect, but, you know, this is only one season, and, like, they treat him really like this icon kind of returning.
Yeah.
And that's a huge gambit to make, and I think they pull it off. I mean, I think part of that is due to Kiefer's performance, but, you know, it's like treating him like he's James Bond coming out of retirement, you know?
Yeah, I think so.
They give him this almost kind of like this, like, complex mythological status where when you sort of zoom out, you're like, this is the second season of a TV show, you know? Like, and they're treating the character as an icon, and maybe it's like it's like one of those fake it till you make it type things where it's like, well, had they not done that, he might not have become one, you know.
Yeah.
But the fact that they said, this is how we're going to treat this guy within the show is like really interesting.
Yeah. I had sort of forgotten that he was like the director before, simply because we're so used to seeing, like, we're like his sort of post, like the rest of the show, like he often just feels like such of a renegade that I always forget that he starts out in the technically as the CTU director.
Yeah.
So like it helps with that, like just like it would make sense that everyone knows him and respects him and think or resents him also. But like it sort of makes sense that everyone would have that reaction as he goes back in. This is maybe a vain hope. But I feel like the CTU stuff might end up being on the good half of the of the season, just based on these first couple episodes. I think that it feels a lot stronger. Or maybe not a lot stronger, but like there are certain elements of it that I like much, that I feel like balances out much more than the sort of holding pattern that it was in for a lot of last season.
Yeah, and I think there's a couple things about that, which is, again, like, I think that, you know, George Mason having, like, the stubble and also just being, like, stuck and, like, like, okay, first, like, he's just great here. Tony is, like, also kind of pissed off about the situation. Like, he doesn't want to be working for George Mason. He needs a haircut. Yeah, it feels more lived in, and some of that is earned from the previous season.
Yeah.
But I also think, you know, not have, and again, I really don't recall where the plot of this all is going to go, but I think not having that obligation to keep coming back to this idea of the mole, mm-hmm, right? Where a lot of times what that means is we're going to show you a bunch of stuff, but nothing's going to happen. I think that's better. I mean, it starts to shade into that territory a little bit with the whole find Kim thing. But it never overstays that stuff. These episodes, anyways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. There's still a lot of the season to go, so we'll see how it goes. But like, I do think, well, also, I think that a great deal of my affection for the CTU stuff is like I think I've always had a great soft spot for Michelle Dessler, just in general, especially Rachel Ellsworth's performance.
Yeah,
and I like, apparently that this wasn't actually part of the they weren't originally planned, because I assume that you do remember that she and Tony have a very long romance.
Yes,
like
yes.
The romance plays a great deal part of it.
Yeah.
I think that apparently it wasn't originally like intended, but then like they decided to work with it, which is sort of crazy to me considering how much chemistry they have just immediately.
Yeah, yeah.
Like it is sort of insane. Like in like the second scene that they have, together, they're like basically like inches apart, like for most of it.
Yeah.
It's just like it's such a, I feel like they honestly have a lot more chemistry than Tony and Nina had.
Tony and Nina had no chemistry. Let's be in retrospect, the show kind of retcons that a little bit.
Yeah.
And gets away with it.
Mm-hmm.
But in the moment you're like, I don't believe that these two people care at all for each other in any way. I also like that we're like, we have the second, you know, we have the public beta version of Chloe. We haven't gotten there yet, but we can see how they're trying to develop this role to like get someone permanent in there.
They just could not bring back Milo.
I know. Poor guy.
Like another, that's sort of like another kind of bold gambit that they have two people that they're clearly trying to make sort of like mainstays, the CTU people that actually have dialogue.
Yeah.
Like two people that you've never seen before, and like how they just immediately roll with it. I especially love how Jack is immediately like so closely tied with Michelle.
Yeah.
Like how they're just like, how he's like, once he decides to start working for them again, like he's just immediately all business and just like just nailing down all of the details with Michelle. It's just like, for some reason, like, I just find that really fun.
Yeah, I think it works. You know, Jack is a consummate pro.
Yeah.
And I think the sequence of events here does once again bring up a lot of questions about Jack's resume. Which is like, okay, so last season we established he was like in or with Delta Force at some point. Now he's done some kind of like undercover like crime work, which seems like it would more be like an FBI kind of thing.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't seem like it would really be in CTU's purview.
Yeah. I guess my real main problem, because I don't think he had actually done any undercover he wasn't really mentioned as having done undercover work last yeah. season. And like, of course, as we go along, there will be many moments where he does undercover work. But like, this is a guy who was literally on the national news suspected of trying to assassinate the president. Like, and like, you know, like, of course, like, he, you know, like, and he literally uses the same first name as part of his cover identity.
It's so, yeah.
Like, I have,
you know,
to assume...
honestly, this is the magic of television to melt your brain, because that just didn't even occur to me. The name thing sort of did, but it's like, yeah, this is, I like, he was all over the news. Yeah. Just a year and a half ago, you'd think his criminal buddies would have seen that at some point. Mm-hmm. Because it's not like, you know, it's not like he, like, they're in LA. Like, this would have been like a big news story, you know?
Yeah. Like, yeah, like, even if they didn't really mention that, oh, like, because I'm pretty sure that they did, like, maybe it was Sherry or someone like that leaked the news that it was, like, I don't remember if it was just an agent or if it was specifically Jack Bauer or something like that, but I feel like there's at least one point when his name was on the national news, like his name and his face, which I think that, I could be wrong about that, but like, it does sort of, the idea of Jack playing undercover is really great. I think it's just like the sort of logistical issues surrounding it.
I'm willing to buy it because it's a rich ground for the show to go into. But as an actual operation, there's like no way.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I like to think that they know him as Jack Bauer as well, but it's spelled B-O-W-E-R. That's the extent to which CTU runs their undercover opera. And also, okay, also, you know, maybe the real thing here is CTU is just not very good at running undercover ops. Because, like, okay, they immediately are suspicious of him and look him up on, I don't know, some database. And, like, was this, why wasn't this information preloaded? If he was already undercover with these people, like, did you have these bases covered before? Like, why all of a sudden are we having to watch the daughter from Roseanne, like, type stuff all of a sudden? Like, they knew what they were doing. I don't really understand. Like, they didn't plan the operation very well. I think that's who it is, right?
Sarah Gilbert. Yeah, yeah, Darlene.
Okay, yeah.
Wow, for nine years.
Okay. I think that's really the only thing I know her from, and that's just from seeing reruns of Roseanne as a kid. So
interesting.
Again, it's a perfect example though of how 24, once it gets where it's going, you can forgive a lot of clumsiness in getting there, because you're like, okay, I do want to see Jack like cut it up with these like toughs. I want to see him break this guy's ankle. That's pretty cool. When he's like working on the car, like leaning over it, like wearing that puppy green jacket. It's so good.
Well, I love especially like how he makes the sounds of the engine stalling. Like he's sort of like pumping the gas pedal. Like it's just something about the specific physical motion of that is just really fun.
Yeah.
And of course how effortlessly he takes down that guy. Like how he like catches the punch without looking.
Yeah. I think they've definitely, you know, he's leveled up between last season and this season. Yeah. He's been grinding. He's been working. He's been bringing his stats up.
I actually feel that about Tony also. I feel like there's like Carlos Bernard, like, his performance has always been good, but I feel like the writers just leveled up his character. Like they just give him a lot more to do. I think like that's what comes with being part of the main cast to a certain degree, but also like it's he just has a lot. I love just like his interactions with Jack always. Like the way he's sort of like trying to convince him to come in, even on the phone call when he's talking to Jack. Like it's also kind of fun.
Like or when he's like leaving the message. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I, you know, I'm recalling last season that a big problem with Tony was just that there's like 12 episodes where you're not really sure what his function is or why he's there, you know.
Yeah.
And he's just given nothing to work with.
That's especially a problem when you're not even quite sure about what Nina's function was in much of that. So like when he has to play second fiddle to the second fiddle.
Yeah.
Well, really the third or fourth fiddle. Like it's sort of a, it becomes a problem. But like he feels established. And also Michelle feels very established too, which helps a lot as well.
Yeah, and the show's not always good about that with
yeah.
its mm-hmm. secondary cast of like having them feel like they belong there right away.
Right. Yeah. Also, I do have to mention just straight up at top that Michelle being part Asian does play a great deal of my affection into the role. just to have a key character being partly Asian, that definitely does.
Yeah, well, they are balancing. They are maybe trying to balance out the first scene a little bit with.
That's true.
I know there will eventually be, we're already getting into Orientalist villains this season, but I know, China will play a big role. I forget, do they have like a North Korea season?
I don't think so.
Yeah, I can't.
I think you might be confusing it with Die Another Day.
I do love that. Okay, I do love that about Die Another Day, which is that even though it was made after 9/11, they were like, look, we know that Muslims are bad, but we don't want to forget that North Koreans are also bad.
Apparently there's exactly two mentions of North Korea in the entire show, and neither of them are vital in any way.
That's very strange.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It
doesn't feel like a target that they didn't want to touch either. Like I wouldn't really see that. Like,
no, I don't no. think they. This is okay. Maybe this can get us into a note I have, which is I think this is something we touched on last mm-hmm. season a little bit, but I really do think that one way to understand this show is especially as it goes on, is like a liberal fantasy of the Bush years if Obama was in charge instead.
Yes, exactly.
Like the way that Palmer, gives that speech to the prime minister of unnamed Arab country.
Yeah.
And then the way that he also kind of like pushes back on the guy who's like, trying to start a war or whatever. Like, is this perfect example of, oh man, the Bush years would have been so much better if we just had someone competent in charge to, to prosecute the war and to, do the war on terror. Like, if only we'd had someone. Like, it's so interesting how this negotiation between these kind of liberal ideals of, well, on the one hand, we're not gonna bomb another country if we don't know that they that they're involved in this, but on the other hand, like directly threatening the prime minister over the phone is like so. Like,
will hurt us, but it will destroy you.
Oh my god! Yeah. I was just in awe of the way that was already being set up.
Yeah. Well, like it's that. Like it's that, like also the prime minister like saying back, you will have made an enemy of over a third of the mm-hmm, world's population. Mm-hmm. That's another good thing. Like I don't think it's even. I think the thing I was really most worried about, like partly because I knew like what the overarching sort of very funny, very strange like villain hierarchy of this season was like that. Like I knew that like the like. A potential invasion would definitely play a big part of it.
Yeah.
So, I think that like what really gives that sort of liberal vision of like a sort of conservative, I don't know, outlook on the world is that like you don't really know. They don't mention before that he doesn't want to go into it unless it actually happens. You don't get that until like immediately after this phone call. So I was a little bit worried. But like once that happened, like it just really clicked into place. Just like how sort of amusingly far fetched it was.
Yeah, it's like only we could have a good guy in charge.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, then they could tell other people off, but they could use the power wisely.
Yeah,
And I also just to like circle back around a little bit, I love the like bunker space that Palmer goes into,
which is in like 8 miles, I think, south of Portland.
Yeah. It's so funny because, of course, like Michelle Forbes is there.
Yeah.
And they're in this space. And
another person who you just get no introduction to, but who like fits right in
immediately because she's a pro.
All women, all women also.
Yes, consummate pros, all of them. But as my wife pointed out, like immediately when we cut to that space, she's like, "This looks like Star Trek." I was like, "Yeah, this looks like a set that they would use on Enterprise."
I want to think that like once Dennis Haysbert knew that Michelle Forbes was cast, that he had some input into the space.
Oh, that would be so great. Yeah. Yeah. Even the way, I'm going to get in the weeds here, but it's fine. That's what this podcast is for. But yeah, the way that even the spatial arrangement of the place is sort of like Deep Space Nine, you know, Cisco has his office, right? Uh-huh. Which is kind of off of the sort of main control area.
The promenade.
Yeah. It's just so funny.
Recessed or like the pit, or I don't remember what you call it, but like the sort of like the step down area where the conference table is. Speaking of the there's a good chance I might forget, so even though it's like even more careful than Top Gun Maverick in not mentioning which country this is.
I think of Maverick immediately when I was like, they're not gonna say, are they?
Yeah, apparently there is a like just some random like file or photograph later in the season that just says like it says it's from Kandahar on it. so they made all this effort to not mention Afghanistan once in the dialogue. I don't think they actually mention it at all throughout this season. But then just like some random prop like completely gives up the game.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, you know, like even in some ways, it's less careful than Maverick, because thing that's weird about Maverick is that it is a nameless, faceless, you know, enemy. And even when they go into the like geographic space, it's like the geographic space of three different countries.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, but very much here, it's a process of, look, you know, and I know that these are the bad guys, and there's a lot of them. And they live over there. Doesn't really matter. It almost has the opposite effect of Maverick, which Maverick almost has this kind of alienating, obviously on the one hand, you can just watch it for what it is, which is just like military propaganda, whatever, fun movie, etc.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, it almost has this alienating thing in its unwillingness to reveal anything like real world political, like geopolitical in that sense. Whereas this is more like, the sort of interpretive outcome is it literally doesn't matter. It could be any of these countries because they all do this. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like a little bit different vibe, but it is very funny. Like the sort of linguistic gymnastics they go through not to say anything. They could have just made up a country.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that this is the kind of show that would do that, but it could have been that kind of show.
Yeah. I mean, like it's also like that's definitely the vibe I get from the entire wedding sort of plot of this, where it is just like this sort of thing where it definitely feels like it's just sort of no matter how it turns out, like it's sort of still like just the overt hostility, especially on Kate's part, is just like it's so much that you can't really walk that back in any way.
It's the opposite of that 30 Rock episode where Tina Fey reports Fred Armisen as a suspected terrorist, but then it's actually that he was just training for The Amazing Race. It's like that, except I feel like I'm pretty sure that this lady, I haven't even bothered to learn these characters' names yet in the wedding plot, so fill in the gaps, listener.
Sure.
But the suspicious lady, I assume she's going to basically be right about this guy, that he's shady. Right.
I won't say, but like it's just like even just like the just when they're talking and then like she sort of like she like tries to say that he's insinuating that her sister's like damaged goods or something.
Yes.
Like that.
Yeah.
But it's just like it's too much. It's too much immediately that like you can't really like do anything with that. And should know also that that Sarah Winter is second credited, so you know that she has an extremely large role season to come.
Well, I know I do sort of recall that I feel like the second part of this season involves more the like some kind of false pretense of going to war, right? Sure. So it becomes mm-hmm. another kind of like palace intrigue type thing.
Mm-hmm.
I know the vague outlines of it, but yeah, another problem is that, like you said, it comes on too strong, A, and B, none of these characters have any chemistry. So it's it's like they've all just met for the first time.
Yeah.
And they're talking to each other in this way, and yet mm-hmm. two of them are engaged, and mm-hmm. The other one, the sister, you know, presumably has met this guy before.
Yeah.
I also, the dad definitely has a... get out, I would have voted for Obama at the time. When he's yeah. like, you're not saying that because he's from the Middle East, are you? Which again,
I raised you better than that. Or no, yeah. you raised me better than that or something like that.
Yeah.
Also, like, I couldn't tell, like maybe it was just, I'm bad with accents, but like I could swear that at certain points they're trying to do like a southern accent sort of thing.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, except the dad is not doing it
no.
at all. But yeah. the two sisters, I feel like, are.
Yeah, and we also have another moment where, like, it's you could try be seeing them as trying to do like a parallel where, like, it's like another mom that died early.
Yeah,
But like they're just not really going for that. Like, there's sort of, but not really, like a surrogate mother sort of thing going on between the sisters.
Yes.
So it just doesn't, like, none of that really comes off. Instead, you have her like trying to tear apart this guy's very nice sports car to find his passport.
Yeah, so. and also just like so clumsily rifling through his things, you know.
Yeah, this entire thing's a drag. Not nearly as much as the Kim stuff.
I was just about yeah. to say, yet somehow, but, yeah. yet yeah. somehow,
yeah, like,
coming
yeah, like
up the... in the rear is still the Kim plot. I feel so bad because it's immediately the stupidest thing this show has done. And I'm like, you know,
like, yeah, like I was really longing for like the sort of comparative restraint of all the Rick stuff from last season. Like at least that sort of stuff, like, it kind of made sense because like she's sort of
yeah
deliberately like cast in the sort of role of the dumb teenager, like, and you know that's not necessarily a you know like a great role or anything like that, but it's still like it, you know, it gives you something to do, whereas like you just have her as a nanny with this guy who at first is immediately sort of this enormous perv, and then you have him being an abuser, and then she's on the run again from this guy who is absolutely not connected with the rest of the plot at all.
Is he? So he's never connected with it?
As far as I know, he okay. isn't. I could be wrong about that, but I'm pretty certain.
Yeah, because I feel like it's so annoying because I feel like the tension there is, mm-hmm. okay, part of Jack's, you know, deal mm-hmm. is that, look, I'll do this, but you gotta get my daughter out of the city if things go bad.
Yeah, yeah.
Know? Which seems reasonable. That
I love
seems...
that also. I love that he immediately just like walks out of the conference room and then calls her.
Yeah, yeah,
and also that Tony, like, even though they're like on some kind of lockdown, Tony just like doesn't stop him at all.
Yeah,
he just knows there's no point.
Yeah, it's also like, you know, don't they probably have some system where you have to like dial 9 to dial out of the building? You know, like, don't mm-hmm. they, can't they just turn that off when they're all locked? How does that work? But yeah, so yeah. I sort of get that. Like, I sort of get why Kim would be tangentially involved. You know,
yeah.
But it's like, why does it have to be this huge melodramatic, like, what if it was just like, she was like it didn't need to be such a big melodrama, I think. And yeah. and particularly the way in which, again, it just comes on so strong.
Mm-hmm. Like, I honestly would have been like another sort of, I think a fun perverse choice would be to just see Kim doing just regular nanny stuff during this whole thing while
I told, yeah.
yeah, like where you have this sort of tranquility, like heavily contrasting with the rest of it. Like that's, I think that like, we'll obviously talk about the hacksaw scene, but like, but the thing that like, I had totally forgotten, like, of course I had seen the scene before, like many times, I've watched it many times recently. But the thing I totally forgotten about that scene is that it cuts from Jack saying like, I need a hacksaw to the little girl cutting the doll's hair.
It's so good. There's like a humor there.
And yeah, that's like a Unshinandalu or something like
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Yeah, it's exactly like that. Yeah, and I'm with you. I feel like, you know, there eventually needs to be some tension there of like, Jack wants Kim out of the city, she's not going, whatever.
Yeah.
But I feel like that could have just come out of their seemingly fractured relationship.
Yeah, right? And like that scene where, like, actually I think that all the stuff even before Kiefer gets back in action, where he's just like, when he's talking with Kim and then he's just sort of moping around his like kind of nice, kind of not nice apartment.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Those scenes are like genuinely like really touching.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Like, yeah, there's like a, also we're like firmly in the Kassar era. There's like, I think two moments that I really liked. Like one where like it cuts, like there's like this sort of light flash between Jack and Palmer, like when they're in the cars.
Yeah,
like, there's that sort of light flash, and then there's like a very purposeful 180 degree break during the scene with him and Kim.
Yeah.
So like it's just like it's really touching. Kiefer and Elijah Cuthbert are both doing great work. So like if we just had that as like this sort of backbone, I think it probably would have been enough. But instead they have to like take it way too far into like absolute tastelessness.
Yeah. Well, and it also feels almost like I think that stuff is working because you can see how Jack is the kind of person who in the wake of this would have definitely pushed away the people closest to him. And you can also see how like, you know, Kim would obviously be traumatized about what's going on and be like, I have to kind of get some space, you know.
Yeah.
And also like Kiefer's like stalking her at work. That's sort of weird. even if it doesn't come off as like dangerous, but rather like this is unhealthy behavior, you
know? Yeah, like this guy, like he doesn't know like exactly how to be a good parent without that sort of structure in place.
Exactly. But the way that they play it is so everything has to be articulated on the surface. Like she immediately says, oh, I can't see you because you remind me of mom. Like stupid stuff like that. Instead of trusting the actors and the material itself to carry it through.
Yeah. Like you could stretch that out reasonably over the course of like at least like 2-3 episodes.
Yeah. I definitely feel like something like that would have been a better way to have the Kim stuff happening in like the first quarter of the season.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, it would be sort of funny and interesting to give this counterpoint of just, you know, minor domestic drama of her like being at her job with this kid, you know, like maybe the kid's a little snot or something. Like you could have had some fun with it. But yeah, they immediately go in this direction that is just, I mean, look, the show at its best moments is doing that pedal to the metal, but you need some contrast. Not a lot of contrast going on in these episodes.
Yeah, I feel like there was a lot more, like, the show generally maybe felt a little bit more abrupt than I remembered.
Mm-hmm.
Like you have that with Palmer just immediately throwing that reporter into confinement. Which is such a good moment.
Another perfect example of the liberal fantasy of, like, running empire properly, which is that, look, okay, sometimes we have to put journalists in a room that they're not allowed to leave. It's not he's not going to jail. He's just temporarily fine.
I love
so
how
that
they,
he doesn't cause a panic. You
know? Yeah, I love how they just signal that with just him in, like, surveillance footage of him just wandering like what looks exactly like a CTU holding room. But yeah, like I feel like in general, like there's just like many things where it's just like point A, point B, point C without allowing for any divergence from that, which, you know, which can work to a certain degree. Like you want, like that's what's so great about the hacksaw scene is that like how driven by instinct it is.
Yeah.
And like also like why like Jack looking at a mom and her son and then reconsidering, like it's like it works because you like that's the kind of person you feel Jack is, like this.
Yeah,
this
for sure.
Yeah, who's like his core is just so innately strong, for better or worse, that it works. Whereas like you have the NSA guy who like I wrote that, like I actually took a lot more notes, but I wrote down it's played by Timothy Carhart, but his performance reminded me of like some amalgam of James Urbaniak and Martin Donovan. it's like it's this like it's just so immediately reptilian. Like,
yes. Yeah.
Like without any attempt to hide it whatsoever. Like he even feels like he's acting from another era for some reason. Like it feels like he's from like a '60s film for whatever reason. There's like a manner of acting that he like immediately adopts, which is fun also, but it's also just like not trying to hide its cards at all.
It still is a show of good guys and bad guys.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
You know, and there's different like shades of that. That it's like, yeah, there's no moment where we're supposed to think, oh, you know, maybe this guy's just trying to do his job or whatever. Like he's immediately a lizard, and we're like, this guy is up to no good. It's so interesting. I've been thinking about it the whole time we've been talking. I can't quite articulate what it is about this season that instantly felt so different. You know, maybe it's just a combination of all these factors of, you know, firmly being in the Kasar Imperium, you know, of like the, even just the setup, you know, being so different from the previous season where it's like, okay, we kind of have the formula.
Yeah.
We know some things to expect, and maybe in some sense it's like the show feels like it can dispense with a lot of the stuff it had to do to get you to buy in.
Yeah.
And it's just like, nope, this is the kind of show this is. We're going to just get going. And I think that's kind of for better or worse, you know? But it does feel like a, maybe it does just feel like a more mature show, or a show that's at least more, more intentional about its identity and like what it's doing. Like there's a confidence that's not there in the first season, I think.
Yeah. There's confidence that's like both for better and for worse.
Yeah.
Heavily depending on which storyline you're in.
Like, absolutely.
The Kim plot is like, it's very confident in what it's doing, and it's very bad for them. So
yes. Yeah. Yeah.
It reminded me of like your sort of point about like them now being in the like sort of in the halls of power now, like, you know, actually following the president.
Yeah.
Like that does make a difference. And I realized something that I found very amusing is that like in the sort of rundown of like agencies that they're notifying, that like CTU isn't even mentioned.
Yeah. Yeah.
like that is a sort of fun tension I sort of forgotten about the show, is that CTU is kind of like low ranking in the hierarchy of national defense.
Yeah, and we do get yet another sort of like at the end of episode two, we do get another kind of tossed off like, this agency, CTU, LA counterterrorist unit, CTU. Yeah. Like people don't, even after the events of the previous season, it still does feel like kind of a second rate.
Oh yeah.
Posting, you know, it's like, yeah, of course George Mason is stuck there because he doesn't have the juice for the big chair, you know?
Right. And there's isn't he has a meeting like next week or something like that about LAX security.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That makes me think about like where, like how each like local unit is probably like responsible for a lot of like the local municipal things. Like I'm imagining like the St. Louis unit or something like that, just dealing with the airport there.
Yeah, you know, I wish that a different kind of show would have resulted in, you know, kind of a CSI type franchise.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Where we'd get like you know, CTU Houston or something, which would have been really funny.
Yeah.
But because, you know, it really is just an excuse to have Jack Bauer around. It doesn't quite. But it is funny to think about, like, yeah, this is like a local brand of a broader. And again, I'm not really sure exactly where it figures into the kind of jurisdiction and hierarchy of the various agencies, which often that's contested ground anyways. But I do think it does sort of read as like this kind of second rate, you know, gets the scraps that, you know, once the FBI and the NSA and the CIA have all had, you know, and DOD have all had their fill, whatever dribbles down is for CTU.
I think that also makes me just fantasize about like a show where it's almost an anthology, but like you just have Jack shuttling in between various branches of CTU, like having to adjust to like just doing the paperwork for. speaking of also format changes, apparently Joel Surnow wanted to change the show's format for the second season so that each episode would comprise 24 hours rather than 1 hour in real time.
Whoa.
Which would have been like, I think probably a terrible idea, but still like it could have worked if they like, you know, it's sort of what we have is good. It has its flaws, but also like it's a lot of what makes the show work, even if you also have times where Kim has to crouch behind a dumpster for like 30 minutes.
it's the Halloween 3 conundrum, which is absolutely. The only time that you can really reconsider your formula is the second time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And if you don't change it then you're really asking for viewers to reject it. Maybe they should or shouldn't, but
yeah.
I think Halloween 3 is great. But mm-hmm. Then it's like, oh, it's 24 days. It would make it a very different kind of show. And then question of, well, what do you do? You know, what do you do the season after that? Right.
Mm-hmm.
Or the season after that, like,
yeah.
But that is fun. It is fun to think about. I think we'd maybe get some tighter episodes.
Oh yeah.
But I think the story as a whole, I don't think they'd have the chops mm-hmm. for the story as a whole, you know, it's like it can get sloppy within the constraint, but that's sort of built into the constraint.
Yeah. It's kind of the fun of it. Like,
yeah.
Like where you have them making up villains as they go along, basically.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. So I do wonder about that.
That's fascinating. Yeah, I did know, I don't know if you noticed, in Jack's apartment, there is a large book on his desk that just says internet. It's like in big red letters. So, you know, that makes me think, what's he been doing in the last 18 months? You know, like what kind of stuff, this is not a guy who thrives when he has free time. So I'm just kind of wondering what sort of things, like Jack Bauer in, you know, 2017, if this had happened, would have become a crypto guy. So I'm just kind of wondering what he's doing. Maybe he had like an eBay shop or something to fill his time.
An Etsy.
Yeah.
Maybe he just got really into crocheting or something.
Yeah, he's a guy that needs hobbies, you know?
Yeah. Speaking of hobbies, I did really appreciate how Palmer and the reporters sit down at a chessboard. It made me think of the beginning of Jack's first season, season one,
yes.
of course.
Yeah.
But also, as a LA resident, I was just kind of fascinated by Jack's apartment because you see him walking in, there's a bunch of mailboxes right at his door.
Yeah.
But he has sort of a walk up area where he has at least one, bedroom, maybe more. Like, it's sort of it feels large and small in a fun way. Like, it's sort of it's obviously a lot less nice than his relatively lavish home in season one. But, it's still, you know, it has a good amount of space, a good amount of headroom, that sort of thing. I just found it kind of fun.
I feel like it's maybe got, a garage.
Oh, maybe, yeah.
Next to where he was. That's why it's kind of elevated like that, maybe. I'm not sure. That's sort of what I imagined it to be a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also, you know, I do think, I think the set design on the show is always really good. Because both that space where, you know, there's obviously nothing on the walls, there's mm-hmm. all these kind of papers around, and again the question is well, what is he doing, you know, and I think it's partially the reason I asked that question is because it's not like he had a mystery to solve. Everything that happened last season is clear and uh-huh. in the open to him, at least. So I wonder what he's been doing. But then also the sort of fancy lavish rich home that that Kim is nannying in also has a kind of fun kind of architectural features to it.
It also made me
appreciate.
It made me irrationally annoyed that they make a big show about the dad played by Billy Burke getting out and polishing his car.
Yeah.
And then she doesn't, like, when she backs out the car, she doesn't smash into it. I was just so annoyed that they didn't.
She has two opportunities to smash into his car, and she takes neither of them. This is, you know, this is another thing that bothers me about the Kim stuff, is that I do think they had a kind of excuse last season why she'd be sort of dumb.
Yeah.
She's a teenager, all this crazy stuff's happening. Mm-hmm. But I believe firmly that Kim of season two runs his ass over when he gets in front of her in the car. Like, she's doing it.
Like she has enough of the sort of instinct to, like, know that she and Megan have to leave now. Yes. Also, I have zero clue why the mom didn't come with them.
I don't understand that. And the mom's just, like, standing there when he leaves. Like, what's her deal? What's she doing? And I know that, like, you know, I know that this isn't about, like, oh, why don't people in abusive relationships leave? But in the context of the show, it's like,
if you're trying to get your
daughter, gives Kim the keys. Why doesn't she go? And also, why doesn't, maybe she doesn't know the car can be tracked, but you'd think that, like, she would, just go with them, because they're leaving at that moment. It's not like she's being confined. So it's very, it's very strange to me.
Yeah.
It just feels so contrived. It feels like laziness rather than any kind of,
Like, and like, they also, like, reading the wiki again, I just remembered that, like, they didn't just have him just, like, eyeing up Kim. Like, he specifically has to say that she has a nice body.
Yes, yeah.
Like, it's just so dumb and overt about it.
And then, of course, like, that serves as a red herring for, okay, he is a creep, but actually, even worse, he is this, you know, violent abuser. And it also makes me question a little, like, is this Kim's first day on the job? Does she, because it's like, she's got a bedroom there, she seems, the kid seems pretty comfortable with her.
She has her Nine Inch Nails poster up.
I didn't notice that. That's so good.
But yeah, like, I just feel that, like, she has enough of the instincts to leave, and I do like that she just, like, wax it with the tire iron. That is
That's a satisfying exchange.
But but, like, it's like, for it to be, like, just so protracted otherwise, and for her to leave Megan also. Admittedly, it is a very funny image to see her, like, building the boxes around her, but also like, it just, like, I feel like Kim would have known that would go bad. Like, that's the sort of thing that, like, if it like, it had to have gone bad at least, like, three times last season. Like, it should have, she should have known.
It's just, there is a point where the show, is there a point where the show does not do a Kim subplot? That eventually happens, right?
I feel like, you know, because she's not in every season, so I feel like, otherwise there has to be, like, every other season has to have at least some sort of Kim in some very, very stupid trouble.
Maybe it was
funny, like you if you don't see the guy's car, like, as an LA driver who doesn't mind LA traffic that much, like, I think it's maybe a little bit overstayed, like, you see the construction people, they're not gonna take too long to get out of the way, and then she says, let's go down that alley, and then as she's going to reverse, she's like, there's like a van that has the reverse sounds going off as it's backing up.
Yes,
like, it's so.
And then she, like, thinks that, oh, I'm in a car, the safest thing for me to do is
get out of the car instead of, like, wait for the guy to, like.
Another thing is just, like, why isn't she driving to CTU? She knows where it's at. Uh-huh. She knows her dad is there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what's she doing going to a police station? Like, she knows someone who's higher up than that. You go to that person and then they take you to the police, you know, and do whatever. It just,
like, she doesn't even pull the sort of standard thing of waiting until the person who's been pursuing you comes up to the car and then floors it.
Yes.
Like, she just waits for him to come halfway close and then they get out and run.
Yeah.
Well, also, like, just like another sort of, like, fun stupid as opposed to stupid is just, like, the moment when she locks the car and that the guy just unlocks.
Oh, that was great. Yeah.
That and the sort of the surprise car backing up moments, like, those are the fun, stupid kind of parts that I like about the Kim stuff, and then the rest of it is just so objectionable.
Yeah, I just feel like if they just respected her character a little bit more,
right?
And I'm not, you know, she's not Jack Bauer, and I think maybe they're trying too much to draw a contrast there.
Sure,
but it just feels like after the experiences of season one, she'd be a little more savvy, and you can see shades of that in like the Tire Iron fight. But it's like, why isn't that showing up before that? Why do all these stupid decisions have to bring us to this point? I don't know. I know the Kim stuff gets exponentially more ridiculous as the season goes on. Maybe it'll be more enjoyable. Maybe we just have to get over this hump to get to something so stupid that it circles back around to being fun. We'll see.
I think, like, I definitely think that it's quite possible that the sort of infamously stupid part of Kim's stuff, like, is the fun stupid kind, so like where it becomes less objectionable.
Yes, yeah. I mean, the mountain lion bit, I'm absolutely looking forward to that. Yes, I can't wait.
I can't wait to see how it plays out. Is really the main thing. Like I'm hoping for like a Jaume Collet Serra's The Shallows sort of situation.
Yeah. yeah.
I like how they bring back Keith for exactly one scene. They don't even bother to bring Nicole back, and then you don't, even though the Palmers obviously appear a lot in the rest of the show, this is the last time we ever see Keith or Nicole.
This is the last we see of Keith.
Yeah. According, I couldn't R.I.P. actually find Keith. It on the episode page itself, but apparently he had scenes in the second to last episode of this season, but his scenes were deleted.
Oh dang.
So like, this is literally the last we see of Keith. He just like is maybe apparently in some other part of their retreat or something for the entire rest of this season.
Yeah, because I mean, presumably Palmer spends most of the time in Oregon. I mean, maybe at some point he leaves, but he's going to be there for a while.
Yeah.
And I feel like maybe they learned their lesson from last season, which is that having the family just kind of like randomly pop in did not exactly generate a lot of productive tension on screen.
I mean, that's also something, like, I feel like they should have learned that lesson with Kim also.
Yes, yeah.
Like, he didn't, like, I feel like Elisha Cuthbert's agent must be just, like, a god for, like, managing to get her, to get, like, make sure that she got main cast status again this season so that they'd have to include her as much as possible.
Well, yeah, because it does seem like the easy move would have been, you know, Kim is off living in New York now or something.
Yeah.
And then you don't have to worry about it.
Also, like, it was also just like, I'm imagining that they were just racking their heads for so long trying to figure out how to get Palmer in on the West Coast so they wouldn't have to work out the logistics of trying to do like a bi-coastal sort of thing.
Yes. Yeah. Although we do eventually get some DC stuff later in the show.
Well, right? Season 7 takes place all in DC.
Yes. Yeah. But I mean, even before that, I think there's maybe, a little more. I could be wrong. Again, it's been so long since I've seen it.
Sure.
Take nothing that I say as truth.
I also loved Palmer's very easy rapport with the regular reporters, where he talks about his conservation quota.
Yes, yeah.
I feel like that's like, I would not be shocked if Obama specifically studied that. Like that's an
Obama joke. That is no, you know what it is. Obama has probably never seen this show, but his speechwriters absolutely watched it. Yeah, it is so. Yeah, it is so weird. I do love. I don't know if it. I know we already talked about like broached the hacksaw line, but it is funny to me that the executives had planned to cut it.
Yeah.
And it apparently didn't get cut, although I can't find any, like, reason why. And it's, like, you know, easily the most iconic line for this season.
Yeah. Like, it's sort of, well I feel like we have to save ourselves a little bit of desserts. We'll get back to that. First, I love in Jack Undercover, like, how he calls the guy Cowboy.
Yeah.
at the auto store.
Maybe on the point of the Jack undercover stuff. That stuff's very fun so far. I think it works really efficiently to be like, okay, mm-hmm. Jack shows up, they're skeptical of him, he checks out, but he knows he's got to get rid of this guy, and that's mm-hmm. how he gets on the job with them.
Yeah.
You know? I'm not really, it's not the kind of show where I'm asking questions of why these mm-hmm. seeming like, you know, the kinds of guys that, you know, would like, race against Dominic Toretto are for some reason working with terrorists. I'm not really asking that question.
Yeah.
Really, I'm sort of asking it in my head, but the stuff is fun enough that I'm like, yeah, this seems sort of stupid and implausible, but I'm having a good time.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I also matter. Yeah, I do like just how much of like these guys are just all meatheads. Like,
oh
all,
yeah.
like it's sort of like it's not even trying to hide that at all.
I and was like, sort of, and I was like kind of, also how like out of place Jack still seems. Like definitely a guy trying to be cool and tough in a way that he's not.
Yeah, I couldn't tell whether like he also did anything to his hair like when he shaved his beard, but like I like the haircut I felt like felt very authentic to the guys like it's sort of like slightly tattery.
Yes, yeah, it's like a haircut you did yourself. Sure.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I do love the shaving scene, though. I don't think we actually see him shaving, but we just, like, see his back, and he, like, looks up from the sink in the mirror at clean-shaven face.
Yeah.
Just like, I wish it would have been kind of cool if he would have had a beard season, you know?
Oh, yeah.
I think he always ends up clean-shaven at some point.
Yeah, at some point.
The beard definitely comes back.
Yeah, the beard certainly comes back many times. But yeah, just like the repetition of like Jack's back or like the feeling of Jack's back, like they really want to imprint it, and like obviously for both of us we very much get it, buy into it. Two Mason notes. First, I love how like when he calls over the department heads, like half of CD walks over. like for one, like even though of course like they say over and over again that Paula's like one of the. Like the best at what she does, like she still does not read as a department head at all.
So like, she's a department head. Well, and also her whole like weird over earnest into self doubt thing is very strange.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also I still can't decide how I feel about it. Does Mason feel like the kind of guy who would tuck his tail in and just run? I legitimately can't decide.
I think that, that's a difficult question. Because I like that moment.
Mm-hmm. I think that obviously Xander Berkeley is killing it as usual.
Oh my gosh,
like,
so
especially,
good.
There's like just so much amazing, intense eye acting going on from him.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, especially in that like first scene with him and Kiefer, where they're just staring each other down,
and Jack is like, "Well, George, I just don't trust you."
I can't just like. I think that like part of what we love so much about Mason is that like he is kind of a snake, but he's the most fun snake you could possibly have.
Yeah.
But also, I don't know if I can see him going quite that far, like immediately leaving. Like I think that like Xander Berkeley plays it as well as anyone really could. But like it's also like I think maybe it's just like I love Mason too much for him to do something that overtly.
Yeah, well, you know, jerkish. I think it's sort of like for me, it maybe would have been a little more interesting if they would have teased mm-hmm. that out a little bit longer.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But I do think that in the moment it was like a fun thing, and to also kind of have like Tony confront him a little bit about like I like the interaction between those two.
Yeah.
I also like the idea that there are so many like middle management people in CTU because George is just like not really good. Like, okay, his management style is obviously going to be like delegating as much work as he can, taking as much credit for that work as he can. Like Jack, I think, was very much a like do it himself kind of guy.
Yeah, yeah.
Like he, you know, he ruled with an iron fist. He didn't put up with shenanigans, but he didn't have like 30 different managers reporting to him. Whereas Mason is like, he's a careerist, but he's also a careerist who is stuck.
Mm-hmm.
So I sort of buy the moment of him being like, I'm going to find an excuse not to be around.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that it would have been more interesting if it was like an ongoing tension for a couple episodes.
Yeah. And also I think that especially because I feel like I just don't get the feeling that he wasn't taking it seriously beforehand until like they got the assessment that it was like 93% likely.
Yeah.
Like I think to a slight extent I felt that same thing with Paula. Just like if you're working literally for the counter-terrorist unit, I feel like you have to imagine that there's going to be some actual threats. I don't think that's necessarily a fault of the show. Like it's sort of like I don't think it's necessarily a bad like a, it doesn't really stick out nearly as much as Mason's does for me. But I also like that sort of that comparison of power, basically, where he can get himself to leave where she can't.
Yes. Yeah, I think that worked. I actually thought the way it was handled for her was more effective because, yes, you work for this thing and you sort of know what the hazards of that are. But I still think it's always an abstract thing. It's always something that's happening to someone else. And you got to imagine there's a lot of people there that are just like, this is just my job. I'm not necessarily willing to die in a nuclear holocaust or to have my family, you know. So I think those tensions and stresses are interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they end up playing out more over the season. But here, I felt like the Paula stuff was a more effective tease of what kind of tension that might cause, in CTU itself, as opposed to the Mason stuff, which, yeah, he definitely is a snake, but I definitely feel like he's a little bit more sly about it than that. I definitely feel like he, once he got that report, would have been looking for his opportune moment to get out of Dodge, but I don't quite think he would have just hightailed it right away.
Yeah, now I'm picturing an entire episode or two where he's just like, he's working with people slightly closer to the door.
Yeah. He just slowly but surely eking his way over there. Yeah, see, that's kind of how I feel like he would play it, is like, but then again, you know, there is this kind of ambiguity about like, okay, it's happening today, and there is maybe a sense in which it could happen at any moment. They're not really sure. I feel like, and then of course, I think that another thing that's not really explored is, you know, you got to be kind of pissed off if you're a CTU person and you know this guy Jack Bauer comes back and he gets to tell his daughter and get her out of there. We all heard him have that phone conversation in the middle of the office, but we don't get to do that, right? Like, I think that's a real, tension that would happen. It's like, yeah, these people are going to be worried for themselves, sure, but probably even more so worried about their families who don't do this job. Like, so maybe you have some buy-in of, okay, look, I signed up for this. I've been trained for this, but I'm not, you know, if I know this information, I'm not going to keep it from my family. You know, I'm going to tell them in as tasteful a way as possible to, hey, why don't you go away for a few days and like 500 miles away? So I don't know. I don't know if it's the show kind of like trying to make a nod at that without getting the whole season bogged down in that or what. Because then, you know, again, it's like how many different characters do we need at CTU doing stuff? And I think they're trying to keep that relatively contained to like the four. I get what you're saying about that moment, which is, for me, it's like as it was happening, it was sort of fun because we get that great confrontation. But in retrospect, it doesn't work quite as well.
Yeah. Partly because I know how it develops. Part of me wonders if it was just like they didn't know how to get him out of the office until besides this.
Yeah.
Because there's no other way that he would have done what he does in the next episode without this sort of panic, moment of panic. But we'll get into that later also.
That's so exciting. I love that you are looking ahead to see what happens and I'm not.
I was thinking about maybe restraining myself a little bit, but then I remembered I remembered like just how many absurd levels of conspiracy there are in this, and so I decided to keep reading.
That's great. I feel like every season one of us needs to do that. Needs to be someone with the inside knowledge and someone who's just like letting it wash over them for the first time.
I also love Jack's secret handshake with
yeah.
I like how it's like half of it, also like half of it they do together, and then like he just like taps it on the heart or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah, his whole kind of like vibe with these guys is really funny.
Yeah. I just love how he like I do wonder if Jack had to like learn how to, I assume Jack knows how to fix a car anyways, but I wonder if he had to like learn anything especially, and I wonder if anyone like went up to him and asked, not necessarily do you need a hand, but like what's the problem or something like that, like at an auto repair shop for
yeah.
when he's there for half an hour. I mean, it takes a long time, of course. I know it takes a long time to mess with cars or fix cars or whatever.
Well, and he's obviously, you know, he's stalling too as part of it. Yeah. So he's, you know, he's definitely milking it.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I like that whole, I like the way that whole thing plays out. I think that's very clever and fun.
Right.
Yeah. Again, I don't know exactly why these people are hooked up with the other people, but it doesn't really matter to me at this point. It's the pleasure, the surface pleasures of it are outweighing any sort of deeper connective tissue that might be lacking.
Yeah. I don't think that, that the, Hulu, even the Hulu version of season one had the previously on 24s. Did it? Or
I did get one.
Oh, you did get one.
I did get one for episode two.
For last season?
I might have gotten one for last season.
Okay.
I'm trying to remember. Maybe not.
Yeah.
I know for sure I got one for episode two this time.
Yeah. I got one for episode two also. I like how that it makes a point to include... I think looking at these in and of themselves will be fun, just like seeing what they choose to emphasize.
Yeah.
And what, the thing I especially like that they chose to emphasize was that was Palmer saying to the NSA guy, this is going to be a very long day.
Yeah. Well, I also, one thing I am sad that we don't get in the streaming version of this show is apparently they had, when they did go to commercial breaks, which was not until after the first episode, there was an announcer that would say, it's a whole new day. We'll be right back. And then the clock would tick. Eventually they dropped that.
Yeah.
But I think it was sort of like a way again to realize there's a lot of new viewers coming in and they don't quite understand the mechanics of the show, because the whole idea was to remind them, okay, the clock is still ticking while you're watching commercials. Like things are happening in the show. And when we come back, it will have been a few minutes, you know, for these characters as well.
Yeah. Like I just want to see the sort of, I want to see the clock on just some random commercial. Just
yeah.
Like the mind wonders about exactly what sort of commercials those would have been. I was thinking about films, but also just like what products would there be if there would be any like insanely inappropriate product or something like that, or like maybe inappropriate for the show.
It's too bad the Hacksaw line happened in an episode without commercials, because I feel like we could have gotten something really funny
out of absolutely. That. I can't think of anything else. We might as well get to the Hacksaw.
Yeah.
First of all, just perfect casting for like a complete like child pornographer guy.
I feel kind of bad for the actor.
Like on the one hand, you know you're getting like this instantly iconic sort of this instantly iconic moments where like you have Jack back. I like also how the Wiki 24 is very careful to specify this is the only person that Jack ever kills in the 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. hour.
Yeah.
I always love that.
Only morning kill.
Yeah, and I also love that how the apparently Wiki24 does not consider kidnapping a minor, a murder in child pornography to make you an antagonist. because he's one of four non-antagonist characters to be killed by Jack.
Well,
I feel like
guess the point is he's a guy that's under custody and is not plaguing Jack specifically.
Well, yeah, I get that, but also I feel like you got to draw a line somewhere.
Yeah, I mean,
like, especially the other people that he kills are like pretty unambiguously like you know good guys in the calculus of the show.
It's more I think coming from how he functions in the plot than as like It is. I love the way Xander Berkeley plays this scene. I think that's even more than the line, which is great.
Yeah.
But I think Xander Berkeley really sells it because he's like, not again.
Yeah. I think that like the episode page specifies that this is the second season premiere in a row where Jack shoots with someone in CTO and someone else asks him, are you out of your mind?
Yes. Yeah.
I also love, like, clearly the conference room isn't that far from the rest of the office. So, like, did everyone just hear a gunshot and then just go out of their business? That and this, like, little bits of blood on Jack's face. I just love the sort of the cut to Xander Berkeley just like shouting, and then it comes back away. it's a perfect scene because it's so contained. It has absolutely no time for anything whatsoever. Like the only piece of baggage you could say was possibly there is Jack asking him his name, and it's even better, like when you know that he's going to shoot him, so he can confirm that he's shooting the right guy.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, it's like how when doctors do surgery, you know, or like amputate or take out a, you know, they always have to double check, right? So that they don't take the wrong thing from the wrong person. So you know, he's just doing his professional due diligence. I love too that the stakes of the scene are a little unclear. Like, you're not sure why he does this. So we get that great payoff later.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. You don't know he's going to shoot him at all. Like, you don't even know he has a gun.
Is it like a bowling ball bag?
Yeah.
Still
a bunch of money.
It's just like, it's so, it's a really great way to like bring Jack fully back.
Yeah, and like that he tells Michelle to leave. I kind of thought that Tony would be in the room also, but like I think it's in some ways even better that it's just Mason.
Yes,
because you have nothing but sheer sort of panic and anger.
Yeah,
because he like pulled some strings to get the guy out of state witness.
Yep. And like and obviously at this point, you know, George knows that he has no control in this situation. Like that, it's not even like he doesn't even like threaten Jack with anything. He's just like, "Are you kidding me, man?" I think season one George Mason would have been like, "Put this man under arrest," and now he knows that that's useless. It's just wasting everybody's time.
Right, right. I think you get like a great shot of like a slight rainbow play over Jack's face before he turns around to shoot Marshall Gorin. Like there's like a nice bit of lightning there. And like also like just when Mason's just so annoyed at not being let in when Jack is conferring with Michelle.
Yes. Yeah.
He's just so annoyed. Also like the conversation between Palmer and Jack on the phone is just so good.
Oh yeah. Fantastic.
Yeah. It was also very funny because Palmer, at least in these opening hours, is wearing a pink button up. And like I was wearing a pink button up yesterday, so like when I was watching it, so like it was a nice bit of confluence there.
That's beautiful.
Yeah. The way Palmer just says now before
games. It's so great. It does make me wonder about the institutional capacities of CTU, because they can't bring Jack in, they can't find his daughter. they have to get the dang president to call Jack Bauer. Now, that being said, I'm really not sure why that wasn't the first move.
That too.
I think Tony makes reference to something like, oh, you're not gonna like it, but like I don't get the impression that Palmer would be like hesitant to do that, you know. Like,
oh, yeah, yeah.
Like I feel like Palmer would be like, yeah, if we need Jack Bauer and I'll talk to him.
I would absolutely see Jack and Palmer having this sort of relationship where like they would like if they were quarantining, then they would be Zooming like every other day.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Like they just seem like, even though it's like not necessarily like it is a friendship, but also it's also like something of a, like a slightly different valence, where it's like this sort of like professional need to check in on each other.
Yeah.
Like especially since like, you know, they've both lost their wives to one degree or another. So I feel like they would have like a nice sort of commiseration session every month or so.
Yeah, there's a and there's like a mutual respect there.
Yeah, that, absolutely.
That I don't, you know, that at this point I don't think Jack shares with anybody else. Really.
Yeah,
I think eventually the Jack Tony thing gets
more it gets complex
and closer. But mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, George Mason is this fantastic foil, so there's mm-hmm. not, you know. just the way that whole thing plays out is just really, really elegantly done.
Right.
Which, again, it's just what's so maddening about this show is, like, it has a handle on certain things, and it does them really well, and then there's all of this garbage
mm-hmm.
that gets in the way. Not even gets in the way, but it's just like, why couldn't you execute this with the same sort of alacrity that mm-hmm. you executed these other things, you know? I'm sure it won't be the last time I complain about Kim or the wedding plot.
I feel like we'll probably do that next episode.
Oh, I'd almost certainly.
I'd be shocked if we weren't complaining about it next episode.
I can't wait. Sounds like, horrible.
Yeah. Yeah, at least we have these buoys at least for now. We'll see how long they last. We definitely went probably way too long, but season premiere, we're back in it. Jack's back. We're back.
Hey, look, when you're only getting a podcast like every once in a while, I think you can sit for an hour and a half. It's fine. You know, do your dishes. At this point, we've probably gone on long enough that you could sit and watch the show while listening to us talk, like a sort of like asynchronous commentary, if that's the kind of thing that you like to do. You know, no one complains about the show being gone, so you can't complain about it when it comes back either. We do what we want to do. We're like Jack Bauer in that sense. We do things the way that we want to do them. Consequences be damned. So
consequences be damned. I feel like we've also, especially since I've been, because you've introduced me to Jokerman, I've been listening to a lot of sense. So I think that we, at least I've adapted like a little bit of that sort of laxer conversational rhythm, which I don't think is a bad thing.
Look, you know, it's, you gotta be a little freewheeling with these things. I'm not a person who listens to sort of recap, you know, show podcast episodes.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't anticipate being the kind of person who makes the sort of traditional show recap podcast episodes. It's fine. And I don't think that's what the listener comes here for.
Absolutely.
Look forward to seeing people in the comments again on the SoundCloud.
Oh yeah.
I've missed it.
Yeah. I assume that you can tell, but this is just you, the listener, can tell, but this is just really fun. It's really like I was basically like you know, getting back into this, and then like it opening on Soul, like I was already cackling.
Yeah. Like, it's so good.
Yeah, like it's just like they're this show is inherently just so funny to me that I that like it, even when it's absolutely dire, like it's usually in a fun way, usually, even when you have this like horrible sound of like a little girl getting a concussion.
Oh my gosh!
It's like this like weird crunch, like
horrendous.
Like I kind of half expected it like blood to start like seeping out or something.
Yeah,
or, like,
to
get like a pretty clear like look at a wound. I guess we probably won't get that, but like it's sort of like it's that sort of keyed up. Like you have to know that like these are the stakes, as ludicrous and offensive as they can be.
Yeah, the show is just the right quality to talk about in this way. Like, yes. If it was a great show, I don't think I'd want to talk about it.
No,
in this way. And if it was a terrible show, it would be like, it needs to have the highs and lows.
Yeah,
you know. I think this really is, at the end of the day, a podcast in praise of mid things, and the pleasures, modest and otherwise, that come from just like, you know, getting excited about the filmography of Stephen Hopkins. I think that's, you know, this is still a podcast for Stephen Hopkins auteurists, but you know, it's like in spirit as well, absolutely, as in practice.
Yeah, like, you know, like we can talk about essentially like the show equivalent of Knocked Out Loaded, like 12, like, you know, 12 episodes times 9, or I guess 10, 12, or those, yeah, 12 episodes times 9. We can talk about like a Knocked Out Loaded equivalent of a pair of episodes every single time. I feel like we can do that. You know,
everything's worth it to get to Brownsville Girl.
Yeah, absolutely. We're not drifting too far from shore.
All right. All right.